This is the Lubetkin on Communications podcast, episode number 44, for Monday, June 7th, 2010. Hello and welcome to the Lubetkin on Communications podcast. I'm your podcast host, Steve Lubetkin. In this program, a conversation with Robert Fry, the former Director of International Client Relations and Chief of Protocol for AT&T and Lucent Technologies. In addition to more than 25 years of experience in international marketing, protocol, and cross-cultural relations, Bob also served in November 2003 as head of the Office of Protocol for the Coalition Provisional Authority for Operation Iraqi Freedom in Baghdad, Iraq. Since 1981, Bob's planned and directed more than 4,000 senior-level marketing and government visits to the United States involving chief executive officers, boards of directors, ambassadors, ministers, current and former heads of state, and royalty. He spoke with us here in our studios in Cherry Hill. Bob, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad you invited me.
Bob, why don't we start out with a basic definition of what exactly protocol is and isn't?
Good. I'm glad you asked the question. If you go into the web or go into books that are written on protocol, you'll find some early definitions of protocol that talk about the first glue. It was a seal that went on official documents, and that was the proper protocol to have negotiations between countries and treaties, and so that you'll see that definition and begin that way as the first glue. The thing that troubled me over the course of time that I've been doing this is that I didn't have a practical, real-world definition of what protocol really is. So I started playing around with this, and it took a little while, but the definition that I came up with, and I've used it many times, is protocol is the art of creating a distraction-free environment that facilitates the complete and open exchange of information to resolve issues and build relationships in international business and global diplomacy. Long definition, but the key to that definition is creating the distraction-free environment. The idea behind that is that if you understand all of the different protocol and cross-cultural issues that surround an interchange between people from different cultures, you will then make everyone feel much more comfortable as you prepare them, set their expectations. They know that they're going to be treated in a certain way that is consistent with the culture that they're coming from. And we go to issues like seating plans and meeting and greeting at the airport, the proper placement of the person in a vehicle as they're transported to the hotel. If they're high enough rank, have we made arrangements with a general manager to greet them at the hotel? Are we putting them on the right floor at the hotel? There are some numbers in certain cultures that you don't want to put them on a certain numbered floor for a lot of different reasons. If you prepare a seating plan, they're very familiar with that, the placement of their flags. If you're going to display another country's flag, it needs to be displayed correctly, especially when it's being displayed with our flag. So all these issues are part of that distraction-free environment. If your customer is coming from another country, feels totally comfortable and everything is being taken care of and there's no surprises, they are going to be totally focused on the business or the diplomacy to take place, and that there will be no distractions, and they will be in a much better frame of mind, if you will, to be accepting of the things that are going to be offered and discussed during those sessions. It's the key to the success of an effective interchange between two cultures, taking care of all of the distractions, making sure they're not there.
Why do companies need to know about or levels of protocol?
We have to go back to probably the early 80s. I was with AT&T at the time, and AT&T decided that they were going to market their products globally. And we were only operating in two countries, Iran and Korea. Of course, the Iranian thing didn't work out too well. So we started putting country presidents in place, expats, and I was asked if I would set up an organization within this new AT&T International that would manage all of the customer visits, very high-level customer visits that we knew we were going to have coming from around the world, mostly from the governments, because governments controlled telecommunications at the time. Now, a lot of that's been divested. So my career had been in sales and marketing. I was doing a public relations job at the time. I was doing presentations for congressmen and senators and military personnel. And the president of International asked if I would set this group up. And I thought, this is very easy. This can't be difficult. I've got all this background. But once I did the first couple of international visits, and they were high-level visits, I realized I had my hands around something that I really wasn't comfortable with and didn't know everything that I needed to know because I'm dealing with cross-cultural differences that I wasn't familiar with. So I picked up the phone one day and called the State Department Office of Protocol. I ended up with the deputy chief. I told him what I was faced with in my job at AT&T, and I asked, can I come down and find out what you guys do, how you do it, what references you have? And he said, yeah, sure, come on down. So I spent about 4 days in Washington meeting with different protocol people in the Office of Protocol at State Department, the C Street location. And then I took all this information, including the book that they use, and I took it all back to AT&T, and I said, we're now going to expand the title of this job from Director of International Client Relations to Chief of Protocol. And they said, that's fine. Let's do it. And one of the reasons for that was that in international circles, a Chief of Protocol for a company has is understood by international clients, as opposed to domestically, where they think protocol is just something that's done at the State Department or the White House. The key here is that for businesses and corporations that are working in an international marketplace, the understanding of the protocols, the business etiquettes, the cross-cultural differences in those things, if you will, can make or break a business relationship. If you ignore the protocols and the business etiquettes on a cross-cultural arena, you are missing an opportunity to really set yourself apart from other corporations that aren't paying attention to it at all. You've got a company that spends a tremendous amount of time on a financial plan, a business plan. All the legal documents are created and all the T's are crossed and I's are dotted. But if they ignore the cross-cultural and the protocol aspects of a visit, a negotiation session, a trip going to see your client in another country, then you have missed an important part of what's needed in that whole relationship with that client, because you now are aware of what the cross-cultural differences are. You're aware of the protocols. Let me be specific. If I'm going to be hosting a Japanese delegation to my business, I need to know that they are obviously more formal than we are, and that's kind of a given. I think people know that. They also know that the business card exchange is different with the Japanese than it is with us as Americans.
It's very formal.
We just kind of hand our card to someone or flip it across the table. The Japanese will turn the card, hold it with both hands, and they will present it to you so you can instantly read it. And for some Americans that aren't familiar with that, they go, well, that's kind of strange. I feel awkward doing that. Not if you keep doing it. Not if you're constantly trying to present your business card, at least in one hand, to another person so that they can read it instantly. Then all you have to do is hold the card with two hands if you're with the Japanese. So it's kind of a rule of thumb.
I've noticed that happening increasingly in American networking settings, that people are now presenting their cards a little bit more formally and people are taking more time to look at them. Do you think that's like a function?
Exactly. Oh, it very much it is. It very much is. So the simple thing like a business card or shaking hands cross-culturally is very different. Some people have very firm handshakes. Other people's are very soft, depending on what country you're talking about. And you have to be prepared for that if you're dealing in a cross-cultural environment.
How do you find out how to do that?
Well, if we shake hands, I know you
we are shaking hands right
we're
now.
We're shaking hands. But as soon as our hands go together, I'm able to determine the pressure that you're exerting, and I will match it. And you do it instantly.
Okay.
But you have to be prepared for the handshake, and I'm using a very loose grip now as we shake hands, and you have to be able to sense that and go, oh, this is a very light handshake. And it's not that it's wrong. It's just different. if people just understand that the cultural differences are just differences, there's no right or wrong, just different, you start to feel more comfortable working in a cross-cultural environment. Let's go back to the Japanese. We've got a Japanese delegation coming in. We've talked about the business card exchange. But the Japanese delegation will be headed by a delegation leader. And if I'm taking, as I've done many times, the chairman of AT&T to meet with the Japanese delegation, a high-level delegation, that where the leader would be comparable to the chairman of AT&T, when I go get our chairman from AT&T in his office to take him down to the meeting room where the Japanese delegation has just arrived, because I met them downstairs, I will tell the chairman, when we walk into the room, I'm going to take you directly to the head of delegation. That's the first person you need to say hello to. Typical Americans will walk into a room and they'll shake hands with the first person they come contact with. And that is embarrassing for the Japanese, especially lower level Japanese, when the head of their delegation is the one that our chairman should meet with first. So I tell our chair, I'm reminding our chairman, I know our chairman knows that, but I remind him, I'm going to take you in the room, I'm going to introduce you to the head of the delegation first, and then the two of them will introduce their teams. And that works very well. Then you have the seating arrangement at the table. All the seating arrangements that we use in the multiple meetings that I've done over the years, we always produce a seating plan based on protocol. I send it to the delegation before they arrive so that they know what the seating plan is. And we together decide what the final seating plan will be, because you do make some changes to the protocol plan. The protocol plan might call for a long oval table with the two principals in the center of the table on either side, so they're directly across from each other, and then moving away from them in pure protocol rank order are there other members of the delegation. Once you do the first cut at that seating plan, you then have to fine-tune it so you end up with the two attorneys across from each other and the two financial people and maybe the two marketing people across from each other for the dialogue to happen very well in a negotiation session. But that's the fine-tuning of a seating plan. But you never really change the six people that are at the center of both sides of the table. That you leave alone, because those are the highest level ranked people at that table.
Now, I know that in government circles there are orders of precedence for Yes. Who goes first, who goes next, and when you're having a formal state dinner or something like that.
And that's exactly what you're talking about. You're talking about an order of precedence. I will ask the delegation that's coming, give me your team in the order of precedence, their rank order. Of course, I know what my delegation is, so I now have my plan. I now just plug it in, look at who is where at the table. I may fine-tune a little bit to put the attorneys across from each other, as I had mentioned. And then I'll send that plan to the visiting delegation ahead of their visit so that they understand that we are prepared. And if they have any other fine-tuning that they'd like to make, I'm more than open to do that. That way the expectations are set. They feel very comfortable going into the session because they know what to expect. They don't feel uncomfortable. Typical Americans will invite people into a conference room and they'll say, make yourself comfortable, sit anywhere you'd like. And that is very uncomfortable to people coming from another culture, another country. They like a plan that's based on order of precedence.
So what would for a company that doesn't have a chief of protocol but wants to be sensitive to these kinds of issues, what are the first things they should be doing?
Well, if you go on the web, you can look up a lot of stuff. You really kind of have to know what you're looking for, but if you plug in the appropriate words, you can come up with quite a bit of information. You'll probably also find the website for the company that I work with, my partner down in Washington D.C., which is the Let Group. And Cynthia and I have been working for a number of years. We do workshops for corporations and businesses. We do one-on-one sessions for executives that want to get up to speed, if you will, on the international environment and how to react and act within that environment. So there's a lot of information on the web. There are protocol companies that they're few and far between. The Let Group is probably one of the premier ones. And yes, I'm a member of it, but I know Cynthia. Cynthia was the chief of protocol for MCI when I was the chief of protocol for AT&T. Although there were things we couldn't talk about with each other because we were competitors, we had a very good relationship as it came to protocol issues. And when I left AT&T, or I should say Lucent Technologies in 98, she and I partnered together to offer these workshops and these training sessions for corporations, and it's worked very well. We do them globally, and we do them for colleges and universities as well. Kind of an interesting spin-off. Colleges and universities have so many international students that are coming in for executive MBA programs. They want them familiarized with the American culture. You know, how do I act in America, in the United States? And one of the programs we do every year is for George Washington University for their executive MBA students, and it's a combination of a dining tutorial along with the protocol issues of how do I work in an environment that's based now in the United States and work with executives in the United States. The dining tutorial is helpful for them because we deal with very formal dining. And if you understand formal dining and all the silverware and glasses and where everything belongs and how it's used, you will now feel more comfortable in any dining situation, because the purpose of the dining situation is not how to use the utensils. It's the relationship that you're building with the people around you. And the last thing you need to worry about is what fork am I going to pick up, or which are my glasses and where's my bread plate. I need to know that cold so that I can then deal with the relationship building.
You talked a little bit about the formality of the Japanese in terms of meeting and business cards and things like that. What are some of the other high points that you would advise people to be sensitive to about other cultures, like do's and don'ts? What are some of the things that are really, really important to know?
Well, it's fascinating. I was at a reception just the other night, and I was talking to an attorney who was negotiating. Let's just say it was negotiating a business dispute, and one of the principals was from Saudi Arabia, came to the United States, came to his office, along with several people that were traveling with him, came into the room, sat down. The attorney crossed his legs and pointed the sole of his foot to the principal, having no idea that that was something you don't do with people from the Middle East. The person got up and left, and the negotiation session ended because he performed a very offensive act to the person from Saudi Arabia. Without knowing it. He subsequently found out, and that's why he was sharing the story with me. But the rule of thumb then is you don't expose the sole of your feet to anyone. If you don't do it to anyone, you'll never make the mistake of doing it to the wrong person. So men want to cross their feet, put the leg completely over, or make sure that the sole of your foot is faced away from the principal that you're talking to. Just a rule of thumb. The rule of thumb in greeting people from different cultures is that our personal space is different. I was in Geneva at a huge trade show that we did every 4 years, and I was in the lobby of a hotel talking with a representative from the Italian organization called ERI, and he wanted to arrange a meeting with my chairman and his chairman to resolve some business issues. But his personal space is very close. So he's tall. He's standing right in front of me, kind of towering over me a little bit, and within inches of my face. So now, for an American, that's an uncomfortable position, because our personal space is about an arm's length apart. So he's violating my space, so to speak. But I know that that's the way it is in that culture, and so I'm okay with it. Yeah, the light bulb went off in my head, and I felt a little uncomfortable for a moment, but I thought, okay, this is fine. I understand it, and I just stood there, and we negotiated, and we resolved our differences. But just the idea that you know that this is a difference and that you can react accordingly so that you don't embarrass yourself or embarrass the other person, that's the key to it.
Now, I know in some cultures, you want to be very careful when you're visiting someone's home that you don't express admiration for the things in the home, particularly for the wife, because there's an obligation to give the guest whatever they admire.
Whatever they admire. I think they draw the line at the wife, but yes, that's very true. And in the Middle East culture, if you do admire something, they feel obligated to give it to you. The other caution is, we may take flowers to the spouse if we're visiting in a home. Well, that would be an inappropriate thing to do in another culture, especially if you say, oh, that's a gorgeous display of roses. I think I'll take that. Well, that's a very clear sign of affection, and that would be totally misunderstood if you did that. In the Middle Eastern culture, if two businessmen are meeting and the one Middle Eastern person has his spouse or his children and some of the children are female, you as the American business person should not recognize them until you are introduced to them by your counterpart. If that occurs, then you can say hello, but otherwise you basically ignore them. Especially the spouse.
And that's very uncomfortable for Americans.
We're very used to, oh, how are you? How are you doing? Isn't she lovely? No, that would be an inappropriate thing to do unless you are introduced to them by the principal. And then you have to be very careful of the words that you use in greeting the female guests that are with the principal.
It's fascinating stuff. You spent some time working with the government, particularly in the area of Iraq and heading up a protocol for the Coalition Provisional Authority. Talk a little bit about that experience.
Well, it started with a phone call. I was in Washington at another meeting, and my friend Cynthia Lett, who has the Lett Group, called me and she said, how would you like to go to Baghdad? And I thought, are you kidding? You mean Baghdad? She said, yes, they're looking for a chief of protocol. I got a phone call from a contractor for the Defense Department. The person that's in country right now is coming out. They need to replace the individual, and the function is a protocol officer or chief of protocol. And I thought, oh, my goodness, how long is the assignment? Well, it's listed as 6 months. And my first thoughts were, I can't turn this down. Everything that I've done over the course of 20-some years seems to be focused on taking this assignment. Well, I talked to my wife, and she wasn't particularly thrilled about the idea of me going over there until I told her that they also covered me with $1 million policy, and then so she was helping
me. She said,
me
when are you leaving?
Bag.
Yeah,
that's right.
When
are you going? But no, we resolved the differences, and I think she felt a little bit more comfortable about the assignment because the protection that I would have in the course of doing my job was phenomenal. So I accepted the assignment and soon found myself in Kuwait going through an orientation session in preparation for getting on a C-130 to go into Baghdad for the assignment.
And this was in 2003?
This is 2003. With the United States invaded in March of 2003, and this was November 2003.
So this was still a pretty hot zone to go into.
Yes, it was. They were still launching rockets and mortars into, quote, the safe green zone.
And one would wonder what protocol, how it plays a role in a combat zone.
Yeah. My job was to manage all the congressional and head of state visits to Iraq. Congressmen and senators were coming over to find out what's going on. They were meeting with Ambassador Bremer. They were meeting with General Sanchez. They were meeting with the government officials that were now starting to form the new Iraqi government. And the visits were usually 2 days in length. They would begin in Amman, Jordan, or in Kuwait. And then we would fly them into Baghdad for the first day where they met with Bremer and Sanchez and the ministry people from the Iraqi government. And then the second day would be purely based on what that particular delegation wanted to do. They may want to meet with some troops from their home state. They may want to see the operations in Balad or Tikrit, or they may want to go down to Al-Hilla. So then we would then make arrangements to do this. Now, the Office of Protocol – designed the itineraries. So we worked with the Defense Department, and we did this through email and through telephone conversations, of what that delegation wanted to accomplish. My job was to develop the itinerary that met all the needs, and then I would work with my counterparts in the military protocol to get all the assets that I needed to make the trip happen. C-130s, Black Hawk helicopters. We had gunships that would fly cover as we went from one location to another on the Black Hawk helicopters. We had motorcades that would be set up that would be bookended by 50 caliber equipped Humvees. And then we had hardened vehicles that the principals would be in as we moved from location to location. But the protocol functions were, in essence, the same. We worried about the meetings and the seating arrangements when the congressional delegations met with Bremer and Sanchez, and they were two separate meetings. We would then alter the seating plan in the transition from one meeting to another as General Sanchez took over the principal seat from Ambassador Bremer and then gave a military briefing to the congressmen and senators. But seating plans were important. Who sits where? How are they aligned based on order of precedence?
So if you have multiple congressmen and senators, is it based on their time in office or— How do you figure that out?
That's correct. From when they were, and you have a head of the delegation, so that one of the congressmen and senators would be the head of the delegation. So they obviously would be seated directly across from Bremer or Sanchez, and then based on the rank of the congressman or senator, based on their time in office, that would be the way we would first do the seating plan. Now we may tweak it a little bit. You're only talking about five or six congressmen and senators, so there's not too much of a change.
And is that— is there jockeying among them for who's going to be the head of the delegation?
No. That's all predetermined before they come.
By their protocol people.
There's a gentleman at the Capitol who I also worked with, because that was then determined in the very beginning of the creation of that particular delegation, who is heading the delegation.
Interesting stuff. Any experiences where, with all your preparations, no matter how good they were, somebody did something that was a gaffe? You talked about the crossing of the legs, but that was somebody else's
well,
problem.
Well, we didn't have that. We had a little bit of logistic problems. Sometimes the information flow was not as good as it should have been, and we would have an asset like a helicopter that would be late. But the congressmen and senators understood what they were going into. They're going into a war zone, and the assets that are being used to transport them are also being used for the fight that we had with the insurgents. So if a helicopter is late, or we can't get the motorcade to us quickly because we had to take another route because an IED exploded, they totally understood this. They were very accommodating. We would just rest and take it easy until the assets arrived. But as far as any protocol gaffes, we really had none in the time that I was there. Everything was so pre-planned, which is a good protocol function. The itinerary is created. Everybody knew what they were supposed to do. There was constant communications of where we are, how far out are we. We'll be there in a couple of moments. So everybody was all aware, including when we would visit the hospital and we'd visit schools. The congressmen, when they visit the hospitals, took particular attention to go into the different rooms and meet with the military personnel that had been injured, some severely. And the press, we kept them away from that. That's one-on-one sessions between the congressman and senator and troops from their country, from their state, or just troops in general. It was a very moving experience to watch that happen in the hospitals.
When you're training corporate executives, Bob, do you ever have any who, particularly among American executives, who are resistant of the necessity, or are they mostly understanding that they need to do this?
They're understanding, because I think it's almost like it dawns on them, yes, this is important. I just didn't really think much about it. There's an interesting story. One of the senior officers at AT&T, he was the president of one of the business units, came up through the ranks in sales, and he called me one day and he said, "Bob, my wife and I have been invited to spend a weekend at the villa in Nassau, the Bahamas, of one of the gentlemen that I serve on the board of directors with in Canada, and I don't know what gifts to take." So I dealt with that issue. But I was also aware, after doing some research, that this villa that they were going to was staffed with servants and butlers and cooking staff. So they were going to be dining very formally. And my assessment of this president of the business unit was that he wasn't totally comfortable in that kind of an environment. So I talked to his secretary and I said, "I'd like to offer the president an opportunity for he and his wife to join me for a formal lunch with no one else around, and I will take him through a complete dining tutorial to make him and his he and his wife feel more comfortable where they're going to be going for the weekend." And sure enough, he called me back. He said, "Bob, that's a great idea. Let's do it." So during the course of the lunch, as I'm explaining all the silverware and the usage of the glasses and napkins and all of this, his spouse said, "Bob, do I really need to know this?" And at the moment, the only thing I could say to her was, "Just trust me." And we completed the training session, if you will. And Monday morning, after the weekend that they went away, I was able to reach her. And she said, "Oh, Bob, I can't thank you enough. That's all we did was dine formally in this person's home. And everything that you told us is exactly what we experienced. And just thank you so much for that." And so that made me feel good that I took that chance of asking if they would do that.
Americans tend to be much more informal and relaxed in business settings, and I think a lot of that goes back perhaps to the dot-com era of the early 90s when we did companies with casual Fridays and then casual workplace. Do you think now, with the economy turning, that we're going back to a more formal way of doing business?
No, I really don't see a movement toward more formal business. I believe companies are a little bit more concerned about dress. I think it has gone to an extreme. It has gone to jeans on Fridays, which was traditionally the dress down day, where men and women or men would wear nice slacks and a nice polo shirt. Now it's gotten so much more downgraded, and companies are recognizing that the way a person dresses impacts the way they do their job. And I think that's what's driving a push back a little bit to a little bit more formality, but not the formality that maybe you and I are used to a long time ago, where it was coat and tie
sure.
all the time.
Sure.
I mean, the first time the AT&T went to a dress down Friday, I didn't do it. I felt uncomfortable doing it. Yes, now I've become accustomed to it, but I only go so far in my casual dress. This is as casual as I get.
Right. We were both sitting in golf shirts and khakis. I'm wearing cargo pants, and Bob is much better dressed than I am.
Well, thank you. But that's we could call it. We could call this type of dress a country club type of
sure.
look, if you would.
Bob, I want to thank you for being with us on the podcast, and we appreciate your insights.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
If you have comments or suggestions about these podcasts, you can drop us a line at steve@professionalpodcasts.com. You can also call our comment line. It's 856-861-6146 in the U.S. and 44020-7193-6146 in the U.K. You can also follow me on Twitter, where I use the name Podcast Steve. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. For everyone here at the program, this is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.